Welcome to Season 2 of GLive, a podcast hosted by Gaming Library. GLive is a weekly podcast brought to you by the Gaming Library Curators. In this episode, join us as we discuss the top 50 influential games of the decade.
This is Ron.
And this is Jovan.
Here comes Johnny.
That is so dated, I swear.
I know.
So today we're going to be talking about one of the 50 most influential games of the decade. And it's Suburbia.
Released in 2012 and designed by Ted Alspach.
Yes. Published by
Bezier Games.
Bezier.
Yes.
So Bezier Games is from what country?
Are they French?
Not sure.
I don't know.
Ala?
Why are you asking me these kinds of questions, Ron? It's so hard to answer.
Is it a quiz?
It's so hard to answer. But so, anyway,
not really that
important. We are talking about Suburbia. It's kind of relevant now because they came out with a deluxe edition, which will be...
No, it's a collector's edition.
Oh, collector's edition. But we will discuss that
later
in a bit.
Yeah. So why is Suburbia part of our 50 most influential?
Well, it's a really, really good economic game, I believe. It's really good.
Why?
It's one of my favorites, actually. And
just because it's your favorite, it's part of our list?
Yes! Hashtag influencer, that joke lang. No, it's really good. I believe it paved the way to other similar games like Castles of Mad King Ludwig. And other tiling. Yeah. It's the same, actually. That's also by the same publisher.
Oh.
The same, it has the same moving market, but it was mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
So in this game, you get to lay tiles and build your own borough, and suburb, basically.
Okay.
So I really like it. It's kind of like Sim City that's competitive, because you get to build movie theaters, schools, boroughs, office buildings. I don't know. I kind of like doing
you
that.
You know, when I first played Suburbia, it felt very bitten.
Why?
It's like, oh, my city is so small. My suburb's so, well, it's a suburb. Yeah.
Yeah.
So parang it's like lacking components. Like there could have been something else, like a movie theater or a nightclub or a pub or something, right?
You didn't get to pick those tiles or something. There's some movie theater in there somewhere.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. No.
So yeah. So I kind of like the part where you make that city self-sustaining. I would say, because you build reputation. But the thing is, if a city gains reputation, the costs also become higher. So you have to somehow also build income,
uh-huh,
to generate income to be able to sustain that population growth. So it's kind of parang real life.
Oh, you can't just
keep on adding houses without a means to, like, you know,
feed
the people or keep them entertained, give jobs, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I kind of like it in a way. So, because it reminds me of my SimCity playing days.
Now that you said that, I realized just now that it's so much like SimCity. Like,
yeah, SimCity competitive.
Yeah, so it's just that there are only two main resources or things that you have to look at.
Yes.
Is money and points.
Yeah, reputation. Population translates to... No, no.
Reputation.
Wrong. Reputation translates to population. Oh. Because, you know, if your city is sikat,
more
people
yung
tao.
Kasi, yeah, makes sense.
You know, they would like to live in your city because it's really,
yeah,
you know, doing well. But at the same time, a population boom will not help your city if you cannot sustain its income. So yeah, so I kind of like how it's in a very simplified way. It teaches us that sort of balance. So do you think it's still Bitten Run?
I'm trying to defend this because this is one of my favorite games. With the expansions that came out, I think it was better.
The expansion.
I haven't played most of the expansions.
I've only played two. I haven't even touched those ones.
With the old version, they released two. I think it's Five Star.
Five Star and Suburbia Inc.
Suburbia Inc. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And then
I forgot the name of the expansion with the swans. There's an expansion with swans.
What's that? I haven't heard of that.
Maybe it's a different game. I'm not sure.
With swans?
It sounds like castles. I think it's castles. See, I'm confused now. I'm sorry.
So, yeah. Because
it's made by the same publisher, right? So it's directly influenced by it.
So with the latest Suburbia Collector's Edition, I think they came out with additional expansions Suburbia Con Tiles, wherein the tiles are from the different conventions. Like there's a Dice Tower Con, Gen Con, BGG Con, Kubla Con, and Essence Peel. What's Kubla Con? Have you heard of Kubla Con?
No, I haven't.
What's that?
And it has Suburbia Essence Tiles.
Yes, it has.
So it's really
It has like the Gruga Park where the Essence Peel is held, mm-hmm. and then the Mesa Essence itself, the building.
And Suburbia Nightlife.
Yeah. It's the Nightlife, there's a Suburbia 5 Star, and as well as
Collector's Edition Expansion.
Oh.
Which is, I think, just exclusive to the big box.
The KS1.
Oh, I'm so envious. I'm holding Ron's copy right now. I want one. I want one so bad.
It's actually a KS version.
It comes with a tile tower with a tiny little light.
Oh, and it also comes with 20 different player boards, like 20 different colors.
Doesn't matter for colorblind people though. So, but
anyway. But it doesn't really matter that much when you think about it.
It doesn't change gameplay.
True, it just gives you.
No, it's the additional.
It's an aesthetic.
No, it's the expansions that matter, the additional tiles.
I think it's the exclusive expansions.
Yes.
So, yeah. And more goal tiles, I think, and bonus tiles and challenge tiles.
Yes. So, there's more of everything.
So technically, you can play like all of the expansions
together, probably. But the thing
it's kind of a long read.
It's a long read. Excuse me. Yeah, and also, it's kind of hard to keep track of everything because you have to take out base tiles to accommodate
the new expansion
tiles. So notice that there was a time when we played that I had to mix the tiles first and then count the number of tiles that we are going to include. So there's like a whole chunk of tiles that we don't need during a game because there's a set number of tiles that we need that needs to be on the board.
Mm-hmm.
So it not everything can be played. So sometimes you don't even know you're expecting like a particular building and it's not coming out. Maybe it got discarded in the setup.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's a surprise, I'm not here.
I think that's what's beautiful in this game. I mean, not all games are going to be the same, especially you can
very high replayability.
Different sets of expansions at the same time and even play it like vanilla.
And
if you want.
And also you can do different strategies because you may not have
it depends on the goal that you have.
Yeah, it depends on the goal that you have, but the thing is, even if you don't have income, there are ways to earn money regularly without that income, like the Waterfront Realty or
the Lakes.
The Homeowners Association, yes! Or, you know, placing adjacent tiles next to each other to get money. So I kind of like how you can adjust your strategy according to the cards dealt you. Or tiles, rather. So, yeah. Even if it did not win an award, I like it. But it won. I think it got a mention from Mensa Select in 2013.
Well, isn't that an award?
Well, it is. Well, no, it's not really an award.
What's Mensa like?
It's like the Michelin of the board game industry. It's like, it's not really like a food.
Or, you know, it's like
connoisseur thing, but they give recommendations and stuff. So basically, Mensa just picks out games that every year. Yeah.
For the intellectual people.
Is yes, for the, I think so. So it, so it adds a certain prestige to the game because I believe that Mensa is a very intelligent organization.
I have no idea. It's my first time hearing about Mensa.
Really?
Yeah, I've been
scandalous. What?
I don't really read
my
about
God.
It.
Okay.
I just listened to Spiel and then that.
No, Mensa is a IQ, high IQ society, basically.
Yeah.
So they have a test.
Obviously.
So if you qualify, you can be part of that organization. But syempre, merong mga, I think there are fees and stuff. So I never even bothered. Naks kunyari qualified daw. Pero, no, I didn't bother to find out how to join. But anyway, so that's Mensa Select. So they got selected in 2013. That's the year after they got released, right?
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. So well, even if they did not win any SN Awards, you know, I think this still deserves a really good... this deserves a place in that top 50, I think.
Yeah.
Do you think that in the future that this game will be played a lot of times?
I think. Even if I'm Lola, maybe I can still play it.
I honestly think this game will have a lot more room for more expansions. I mean, we've seen tile laying games get upgraded with playable cards, getting another... I don't know if they're going to put a take that mechanic on this. Like when you play cards, it affects or changes the way you affect the board. I don't know. I mean, right now, the world is changing, the environment is changing, so they can probably add new more tiles. Why not? I mean, go crazy, go creative. But those are things that I think when you're building a city, like...
You consider.
So you have like natural disasters. I don't know, but they haven't done that kind of expansion, like specific disaster.
Hey, I'm looking at the nightlife, new nightlife tiles, and like there are new goals like most insomniac. I think this fits us.
Insomniac.
And look, there's a tile that says game night host. It could be you. It could be me.
Oh, there's like a nyctophobia.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. But yeah, I think for me, the gameplay is already good.
Yeah.
The rules are elegant, I should say.
But
so
would there be any other tile-laying game that you would rather be playing?
There are other tile-laying games that I would rather be playing, but there's not... There's
nothing
it's not
as,
the same.
Nothing as
it's
simple
not the same because
and
it's not as... Say... Most of the tile-laying games I play, they're like area control or something. This is very economic.
True.
So it's very different from my
usual
tile-laying game that I play, like Carcassonne or... what other tiles do I play? Wait, this is a pop quiz. I cannot remember all of my games. Anyway.
Anyway, so for me, I think this game is, it takes actually quite... Not so long, but you don't really notice the time when you're playing it because the rounds are quite fast.
Yeah.
Actually, tumatagal lang naman pag mabagal tumira, eh, di ba?
Yeah, it's the kind of game that you basically do the same thing every round.
Tapos na?
But
yeah.
You get dealt with different things every round. So you don't necessarily just on one round like get all the green tiles or get all the yellow tiles because there are some turns that you don't even have enough money to get any tiles.
Any tile. And then you have to end up like
you have to decide what to discard.
Doing a lake or settling for a standard building and then it's so sad. But it's a good challenge.
Or make sure that the other people don't get the tiles that they want.
Yeah, I mean, you just like either... hate draft or toss it.
And it's not even a drafting game.
It sort of is. Basically, you're buying from the market. So if you deprive other people from buying it from the market, you know, it's kind of like a...
But when you say you draft, it means it's in your hand, right? And then you pass it to someone else.
Okay, fine. You're being technical. So anyway, yeah, so going back to Suburbia, I believe that this collector's edition...
It's worth a buy.
Yes, it's I think it's worth a buy, but it's so bulky. Ah, parang
it's definitely worth it.
All of the expansions.
Pero hindi ko na to kaya i-commute, guys. Ah. So,
but pag pa-i-commute, meron naman dito.
I know. Oo nga eh.
All of the expansions.
Yeah, it comes with a vacuum form, pal. The vacuum form tray.
Yeah. And even as a guide on how to actually
put it back together. But I'm happy with my original set.
Although, I'm actually happy with that.
Even if I only have two other expansions. So
even if just having two expansions.
Yeah.
You will never have... But every game will always be different. Because you play with different people. Mm-hmm. You get dealt with different tiles and different sequences. So, sum it all up. Suburbia is kind of... Not to say random... thing, but it's more of a risk mitigation game coupled with Euro tile placement mechanics and an economic theme.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, it's a very thematic, like city building.
Sim City competitive. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
In like a phrase. In a nutshell.
That's right.
So yeah. So this is Suburbia. I hope you guys check it out, even if you haven't tried it out yet. And stay tuned for more reviews from the curators.
Alright. See you soon.
Bye.
Hi all, Sam here, one of your friendly neighborhood GL curators. In this segment, I'll be talking about one of GLive's top 50 influential games of the decade. Today's game is FFG's Arkham Horror the Card Game. Arkham Horror the Card Game is an LCG published by Fantasy Flight Games. It can be played by 1 to 4 players, provided you've got enough cards to build the decks. A game can last anywhere from 60 to 120 minutes. It's designed by Nate French and Matthew Newman. Nate French has been involved in designing several of FFG's LCGs, including the recently released Marvel Champions the Card Game. Just a quick background. The term LCG stands for Living Card Game, which is a trademark used by Fantasy Flight Games to refer to a card game distribution system that it developed in 2008. Most people are familiar with collectible card games or CCGs like Magic the Gathering or the Pokemon Trading Card Game. The difference between CCGs and LCGs lie in their distribution method. CCGs have a blind buy model where you purchase booster packs that contain random assortments of cards, and where some cards are rarer than others. In contrast, LCGs don't have random booster packs. For LCGs, FFG will typically have a core set and will release expansion packs based on a schedule. The core sets and expansion packs all have fixed, non-randomized sets of cards. There are no rare cards, and you can get whatever card you want so long as you buy the pack that it comes in. The Arkham Horror LCG's core set contains the Knight of the Zealot campaign and consists of three scenarios. Getting this core set will give you a good feel of how this game works. It's also a self-contained experience, so it's a good place to start. In contrast, the expansions are released in cycles. A cycle starts off with a deluxe expansion, followed by six Mythos packs. The deluxe expansion typically contains cards for new investigators, a couple new player cards, and the first two scenarios of a campaign. Mythos packs will contain a couple of new player cards and a single scenario. Each of these cycles will form a self-contained campaign that tells an entire story. Right now, the Arkham Horror LCG is in the middle of its fifth cycle, the Dream Eater cycle. You can opt to just get the base game, and if you want to move on, pick a cycle and buy the releases for the cycle you want. These cycles don't necessarily have to be played in their order of release. You can opt to jump from the base set to the current cycle if you want. You can also choose to play a single scenario as a one-shot, or you can play through the entire cycle as a campaign. I highly recommend playing a campaign because this allows the investigator you're playing to grow and develop as you go through several scenarios. And while playing a scenario might have you investigate a strange disappearance, the campaign will have you investigate several odd happenings and possibly uncover the insidious plot surrounding it all. The core set for Arkham Horror the Card Game was first released in 2016. This game immediately drew my attention as soon as it was announced. But to understand why it drew my attention, we'll have to get into what the game is and how it's played. Arkham Horror the Card Game is a cooperative card game based on H.P. Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos. It's part of FFG's Arkham Horror Files line of products. Some other games in the line include the Arkham Horror Board Game, Mansions of Madness, and Elder Sign. If you're familiar with the games that I've mentioned, then you'll know the general feel of the Arkham Horror LCG, as it shares the same thematic DNA. The game is generally set in the 20s, and you're playing investigators who've discovered some unspeakable evil that they must now try and stop. Throughout the game, you'll be encountering monsters, cultists, and other horrors that will chip away at your health and sanity. I believe that, to date, Arkham Horror the Card Game is the game that best encapsulates the Cthulhu mythos, short of playing an actual Lovecraftian-themed RPG. Alright, so having gone through the introduction, we can talk about what makes Arkham Horror the Card Game influential. It's not just because of the LCG system, or even because it's a cooperative LCG. What makes the game stand out is its gameplay. It's a card game, yes, but it's a card game that's dripping with theme and tells an interesting story. So to start off this game, you'll pick an investigator that you want to play, and you'll build up their deck of cards. Investigators fall into five general classes: Guardians, Survivors, Rogues, Seekers, and Mystics. An investigator deck will be built by picking a combination of cards from the investigator's class, as well as some neutral cards. Some investigators can be a mix of two or more classes. In general, Guardians are good at fighting, Seekers are good at investigating, Mystics have magic, Rogues are good at sneak attacks, and Survivors are good at evading enemies. These investigators will have some backstory, as well as a unique ability, a unique item, and a unique weakness. Weaknesses are things that your investigators will have to deal with if they come up during the game, or else bad things will happen. These might not seem like much, but the weaknesses add a lot to the overall storytelling nature of this game. One of the investigator's weaknesses might be his need to cover up the weird happenings that he's investigating. Another might be in search of a missing loved one, or perhaps they have a divine compulsion to hunt down a specific monster. A weakness could cause one of the characters to abandon the ongoing investigation in favor of chasing down the lead on their missing friend for a couple of turns. This adds a complication to the game, but it's a complication that plays into the theme. Drawing these weaknesses during the game adds an interesting twist, making the ongoing story richer and more dynamic. Another interesting thing is that if you opt to play a campaign, the characters grow with you. Depending on how well you did in a scenario, you'll be able to gain experience points. These points can be spent on adding new cards or upgrading the cards on your deck. Aside from upgrades, the choices you've made during the game can also affect your deck. Some choices will let you add cards representing items that you've found, or maybe companion cards for people that you've met along the way. This system of upgrading cards is something I really like. I'm not that fond of building my own deck. Mostly, I'll opt to play with either the recommended decks listed in the game, or maybe I'll follow one of the deck builds posted online. The upgrade system allows me a bit of deck building without too much pressure. At this point, I'll know enough about the deck I'm playing to have an idea of which cards I found helpful and which ones I can do without. The decision space is minimal since the amount you can change is limited by the experience points you've earned. I like being able to tweak my deck just a little bit. It helps me feel like the character is mine and makes me care just a little bit more about them. So I've talked about the distribution system and how to build the player deck. Now we're getting into the actual play of this game. You'll set up the game following the instructions for the scenario you're playing. You'll get some backstory, the who, the why, and the what of the investigation. And then you'll be laying cards down to form a map of locations that you can visit and investigate. Then you'll build up an encounter deck full of monsters and nasty events that will happen as the scenario progresses. Each scenario will have a sort of timer composed of the agenda deck and the act deck. Generally, Bad things happen when the agenda deck advances. The agenda advances whenever a set amount of doom tokens are placed on it. A doom token is automatically placed every round, but some of the things you do or encounter during the game can add even more doom tokens to the agenda. This is a bad thing. You want to get to the end of the act deck before the agenda cards reaches its own end. The act deck only moves forward as the investigators discover clues and defeat monsters. The agenda and act cards have flavor text on them that add a narrative element to the game. The agenda represents the enemy moving forward in its evil plan, while the act deck represents the investigators moving closer to solving the mystery. I think this system gives the game some nice tension, because the investigators can't dawdle, as the agenda deck will move forward independent of what they do. When the agenda flips, bad things will happen and the investigators will be faced with new challenges and a greater threat. So there's incentive for the investigators to be proactive and take risks instead of waiting for a safe play. Of course, there won't ever be a perfect time to act because the board state isn't static. You see, the game has four phases. First is the mythos phase, followed by the investigator phase, the enemy phase, and the upkeep phase. The mythos phase is when the game sets up the next challenge. During the mythos phase, the agenda deck gains a doom token. If it reaches a threshold, the agenda advances and bad stuff happens. But even if the agenda doesn't advance, each investigator is required to draw cards from the encounter deck. These cards will either be an enemy that will spawn somewhere on the map or some sort of event that will have to be resolved. It's only after this mythos phase that the investigators can act. During this phase, investigators will take turns performing three or possibly more actions. These can be to draw a card, gain a resource, investigate the current location for clues, play a card, engage an enemy, fight or evade an enemy, or move to another location. The beauty in this step is that there is no fixed player order. The players can decide in which order they want to take their turns. This makes the cooperative play here more interesting because it really opens up the gameplay, allowing the players to jump in where necessary. For example, I'm currently playing a seeker and I'm engaged in an enemy that I'm not able to kill or evade. If I try to do anything else, it can attack and quite possibly kill me. My friend, who's playing a guardian, can offer to take his turn first and move to my location to engage the monster. This will allow me to move to a different location to perform a crucial investigate action that will move the act deck forward. There is no quarterbacking here because no one knows what cards the other have in hand. You'll have players offering up ideas on how to proceed instead of just one person dictating to the group. This cooperation is key. It's crucial for the investigators to do as much as they can to improve their position during their turn, because once investigators have done their actions, it's the enemy's turn to act. The enemies on the board will be moving, engaging, or attacking as indicated on their respective cards. The enemy action is followed by the upkeep phase, where investigators draw cards and gain some resources. The mythos phase is a sort of AI that sets the board up in unpredictable ways, and the investigators are free to figure out how to deal with it. Anything that the investigators don't deal with effectively will bite them in the butt during the enemy phase, and then the cycle begins anew with the game throwing even more challenges at the players. Throughout this game, you'll be moving through the map, investigating locations, encountering monsters and people. Sometimes you'll fight, sometimes you'll run, and sometimes you'll try to talk to them. You'll be doing all this in hopes of moving the act deck forward before some other bad thing happens. Periodically, the cards will tell you to take note of a particular thing, and throughout the game, you'll be wondering why you had to note that down. Is it good? Is it bad? You won't know until it finally comes up again. It's a mystery within a mystery, and it draws you deeper into the story. So that's how the game is played, but I haven't yet talked about the most interesting part of this game, the chaos tokens. Each time an investigator is attempting a task, such as attacking, invading, or investigating, there's a skill check. Each investigator has stats for willpower, intellect, combat, agility, health, and sanity indicated on their card. These stats can be modified through equipping items or playing event cards. A skill check will require you to reach a certain level. For example, you might need 5 intellect to investigate a location. So you've got a base 3 intellect, and you play the card that gives you +2 intellect. That means you'll succeed in the skill check, right? Wrong. As part of resolving the skill check, you have to draw a token from the Cursed Evil Chaos Bag. This bag will have tokens that modify your result. Perhaps you'll draw a positive value, which is good, or maybe a negative value, which is bad. Or maybe you might draw the dreaded autofail token that is very, very bad. This chaos bag adds a wonderful randomizing element to the game. You're never quite 100% sure that you'll succeed, so each action is always tense. Could the same effect be replicated with custom dice? Perhaps, but one of the functions of the chaos bag is to scale the difficulty of the game. For easier games, the setup will tell you to add more positive tokens to the bag. For a more difficult game, you add more negative tokens. The chaos bag is a really fascinating way to introduce uncertainty and randomness to the game. There's nothing quite like willingly thrusting your hand inside a black velvet bag of doom to draw a token that will determine the fate of your investigator. Crucial draws will have the entire table yelling in joy or moaning in defeat. I know some people dislike randomness in games, but it works in this game. It's a game about monsters, mysteries, and the unknown, so a bit of randomness fits right in. And yes, that was a Death by Monsters Easter egg. They're awesome. Anyhow, it's this chaos bag combined with interesting investigators with unique items, weaknesses, varying encounters, the act and agenda deck, as well as the overall story that makes this game fascinating. In true Lovecraftian fashion, you're never sure of victory. There's always that doubt of whether or not you'll succeed in your mission. You'll be a bit paranoid with the choices you've made. Was it right to fight instead of befriend? Were you supposed to go left instead of right? Did it even really affect the game? You're really not too sure. Of course, once you've played through a certain campaign, it'll lose some of its mystery. But it's still fun to replay them with different characters and degrees of difficulty. Encounters won't always come up on the same way, and your chaos bag results are always unpredictable and tense. It's a wonderfully captivating game. You get sucked in and you want to know if you'll make it out on the other side with your health and sanity intact. I'm not a big fan of co-ops and I generally don't like deck building, but I keep thinking about playing this game and wondering about the next twist that FFG will introduce. Hopefully, you've got an inkling of why I love this game and why I think it's influential. This is a long ramble, but the gist of it is, this game's ability to weave a compelling story with interesting game mechanics that are able to simulate the tension, urgency, and general creep factor of a Lovecraftian story is awesome. There is nothing in the market quite like it, and I am unsure whether anyone else will be able to produce something that is anywhere close to what this is. FFG's Arkham Horror LCG is a great game. If you're interested in Lovecraftian stories and the Cthulhu mythos, definitely check it out. That's it for now. Thanks for listening.
Hi everybody, this is Ron.
And this is Jova.
And here comes Johnny.
So we're going to be talking about one of the 50 most influential games in the decade.
Of the decade.
2000 to 2019.
Previous decade. Okay.
So tonight we're going to be talking about Codenames. So guys, what can you tell me about Codenames? What do you know about Codenames?
Oh, this was by a Czech dude.
Please sabihin mo na. What's his name?
Okay. Vlada Chvatil. Chvatil. Is it? I don't know.
I think Chvatil na lang.
Okay.
Okay, so this is a 2-8 player game. Playable in, 15 minutes?
It depends if you're really good at it. Because some people actually
No, word games. If you're really bad at it, it can end in less than 15 minutes. Like, you get the assassin.
Okay. Fair enough.
But I haven't really played it less than 15 minutes. So
me neither.
I guess I've been playing with pretty good people.
Okay.
So this is a game by the Czech Games Edition. Obviously, it's a Czech game. And this is, deduction game, party game, word game.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. What else?
Yeah. This is created by the dude who did Space Alert.
What's this Space
Alert? I haven't played that.
Oh my gosh, you should try it. But it's kind of stressful because it's a real-time programming game. But it's pretty good. It's a sound prompt thing. Anyway, I digress. Okay. It's the same dude who did that. So it's surprising that he came up with something that's really different from the other games that he's done before.
Okay, so why is this game part of the most influential games of the decade?
Apart from the fact that it won an award.
What award? Which award was it?
Spiel des Jahres, 2016.
Right.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So, very recent win.
Very recent win. Yeah,
last not so recent.
Four years ago. That's so recent considering there are older games.
Fairly recent.
True. Well, did you know that this game has about 10 iterations already?
Yeah, but I only own the other one other iteration.
So. Pictures?
Yeah. There's, as far as
so,
I know,
okay,
there's
codenames.
Codenames Philippines, there's codenames Pictures. Right? There's
yep.
Codenames Harry Potter.
Yep.
Disney Family Edition.
Yes.
Duet.
Yes.
After Dark.
After Dark. Marvel
that's
Edition.
That's Deep Undercover.
Ah, Undercover.
That's the illustrations that you're talking about.
Oh, okay.
So don't... Oh, okay.
Marvel Edition.
Yes, correct. Did you know?
Deep Undercover Version 2.
No, that's also Deep Undercover. Did you know
the
that there's a
the, Simpsons also.
The latest one is a codenames The Simpsons.
Yeah, The Simpsons because they've been
just,
doing
just now.
No, that's 2019.
Like 2019, Q4.
I actually
November.
I actually didn't know about it until I've been researching about this game.
Because I've noticed recently that a lot of geek franchises get into the board game thing now. It's like they've been skinning things, reskinning existing games. To fit the particular franchise, like there's Monopoly. Monopoly is several also, right? So there are so many, like Marvel, Disney. The Simpsons is the first, I think. I'm not sure.
No, Simpsons is the latest one.
No, I mean like in skinning new games.
Yeah,
I mean
re-skinning
games.
This is going to be like Monopoly. How many skins can you think of?
Yeah, because Monopoly is like a lot.
Lot.
So
like
now Codenames is getting there.
Yeah. Oh, did you know that Blizzard? Do you know Blizzard?
Yes.
That they have Codenames Blizzard Edition.
What?
What?
It came out last year as
Sorry,
well.
The only thing I know about Blizzard is Diablo and Diablo 2 and Diablo 3.
Well, I just found out
that's the
about
only thing
because
I played.
I'm researching about Codenames, but then... apparently, it's not for retail. It just came out as a party like event exclusive.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So it's like a temporary.
That's why nobody really heard about it because it wasn't really
an
for sale.
Exclusive.
So
it's exclusive.
Very exclusive.
For elitist.
No, but at least they're open to those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But going back to Codenames and the game mechanics, how do you actually get into Codenames? They're usually like in the vanilla Codenames version. There's like words on cards.
How do you play the game? Yeah.
So there are words on cards, and then you lay out those cards in a grid of I think 5x5.
Yes.
If I'm not
correct.
Mistaken. And once you lay that out, the two teams have different configurations to solve. Two opposite teams, right?
Yeah. Red and blue team.
They have different configurations to solve, and the first one who solves it wins.
Yeah, we'll get all their words.
Get all their words. But it's kind of tricky because you need to solve as many as possible.
So there's basically two spy masters.
Yeah.
So one for each team, and then they give out clues for the other teams to
for their teammates
to guess their words.
Yeah, and the thing is, they're only limited to one word, right? One
yes.
clue.
Giving
out a clue is just one word, and you'll have to make sure that clue can give as many, yield as many
answers.
So like if you give out a clue, let's say my clue is dog and I say three, which means that my clue dog pertains to
three cards. Yes.
Three cards on the grid. So I have to make the guessing efficient by making my teammates guess as many as they can in one go.
Right.
So I think that's that.
And of course there's the assassin, which
yeah.
The both teams are trying to like Avoid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that signifies end of the game, right?
Yes, that's why you can play until 15 minutes or less.
It's the same with Harry Potter code names, but the thing, the difference with that is that it's co-op.
Really?
Yes, it's co-op. Basically, you're just trying to gather the Order of the Phoenix and avoid two Death Eaters.
Okay.
And then at the same time, even if it's co-op, they still work with two teams, still work with different configurations.
Oh.
And it's possible that somebody's team's Death Eater is somebody else's
clue,
Order of the Phoenix. Oh, no. Yeah, so it's kind of like, so it's nice if you get to cover the Death Eater of somebody of your teammate. So it eliminates the possibility of ending the game.
Know that.
So it's, and they have like mission logs where you can choose locations and fulfill missions. But personally, I haven't tried that yet. I haven't gone there yet. So we've only tried the basic rule of co-op.
Other than the award, why else do you think that it's considered as a very influential game of the decade?
I think it... for me, it kind of bridges the gap of the casual gamer and the connoisseur board gamer, I think.
In what way?
Because I think you can introduce it to new players without difficulty. But players who are used to heavier games can also enjoy it at the same time.
Well, you know, for me...
What, do you enjoy it?
I enjoy it, but then I think that game is for people who are like...
I also like board games, so...
Very intellectual?
Not really intellectual. See, here, if
you... It's more of creative.
Or creative, more
than anything.
I know certain people who do not like board games, right?
Yeah.
But what I found is that speaking... from a professional point of view, because there was one time I was brought in to consult for a board game cafe in the province, and we used Codename Philippines Edition. I was teaching waitstaff the game, and they got into it, and I did not expect that they would really connect with the game, because most of the time, like, the words that we find in those games are, yes, in a way elitist, or people with better education can maybe enjoy this more. But that that particular moment, it kind of disproved that stereotype, I think. Because the local version of Codenames kind of bridges that socioeconomic gap, should I say?
Well,
I don't want to sound classist or anything. I'm just saying it as a matter of fact.
I honestly think it's a creativity game. I mean,
yeah. So
it's good because it's so good that they've allowed different countries like to adapt their own editions. Like Malaysia has their own for their own language.
Really,
you know?
They do.
Yeah, they do. And then for us, here in the Philippines,
we have our own
edition, so that you know. People who have a hard time speaking
in English. That's the thing also. It's the language barrier. It's the class barrier. It kind of bridges that gap, because I had to water down the rules, because the rules are in English. And the thing is, I can't expect people with limited education to actually read through the rules and understand them off the bat. So I had to explain it to them clearly, or at least like... in a way that they can
comprehend
and not feel alienated by the game.
So do you still actually play the game?
I'm not sure if they do play the game, but I'm pretty sure they enjoyed it, because they after I left, they kept on playing it.
I haven't played it recently, but if, for example, I have like 4, 5, 6 friends over, and I want everyone engaged, I would probably
bring that out.
It's one of the first few games I will bring out and have everyone join us in, because it's easy to teach, it's fun, and it's, I know, it's sometimes nice to play when you're doing like...
So do you think there's any other game out now that has replaced Codenames?
Well, there are a bunch of word games that came out though. So basically, I think Codenames paved the way to other word, similar word games like Just One and Decrypto and maybe
Trap Words.
Trap Words.
So
I still prefer Codenames though, but Decrypto is a close second.
I haven't tried Decrypto. You have to let me try it one time.
Next time.
But yeah, I personally I have the Harry Potter copy, and it's awesome because there's a picture version and at the opposite side is the words version. So I can
you can choose to play
with pictures or you choose to play with the words side. And I think you can still play it with the original rules, I think.
You know what I like about this game? That it has a double XL version. So it's bigger cards.
I think double XL versions for both the original Codenames and the pictures.
The pictures, yes.
So, yeah. Yeah, I think big games are now also a thing, you know? They're table hogs, though, so.
But it's very great for parties.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there. So, I think it really, it's a really good game that paved the way
to a lot of new titles out there that are also really good. It definitely did, like, affect how games later on social deduction, word games are now being made. Like, say, for example, the crypto. So, I could see a lot of more and more games getting inspired with how Codenames did it.
Yeah. So, I think we covered as much as we could, right? Talking about Codenames. Do you have anything more to add, Ron?
No, nothing else. I think that's about it. So,
Stay tuned for, you know,
other reviews.
See you soon.
Yeah, see you soon.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for your time.